Black Lives Matter, Antifa, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, January 6th. Sounds like it's time for episode 46 of Pop Art, the podcast where my guest chooses a movie from popular culture, and I'll select a film from the more art classic side of cinema with a connection to it. I am your wake up host, Howard Kastner. Today, I am happy to welcome producer-director Martina Silcock, who has chosen the controversial and game-changing Spike Lee joint, Do the Right Thing. And I have chosen the astounding first feature by French filmmaker Lodge Lee, Les Miserables, both about racial tensions that explode in a single neighborhood in a single day, leading to acts of violence and riot.
My name is Martina Silcock. I'm a producer-director originally from the UK, as you can tell from my accent. I now live in LA. I've been here for 3 years. I'm hoping to stay for a little bit longer. Yeah, the films we're going to talk about are things that are very important to me and I've been talking to a lot of people about.
Great. Well, with that, let's get to your selection, and that is Do the Right Thing. First, some information about the film. Do the Right Thing is an American film released in 1989. It was produced, written, and directed by Spike Lee. It stars Spike Lee, Danny Aiello, Ossie Davis, Ruby Dee, Giancarlo Esposito, Bill Nunn, John Turturro, Richard Edson, Roger Winvere Smith, Rosie Perez, Joy Lee, Steve White, Martin Lawrence, Robin Harris, Samuel L. Jackson, Rick Aiello, Miguel Sandoval, John Savage, and Nicholas Turturro. The story revolves around a Brooklyn neighborhood during an exceptional heat wave. As the temperature rises, tensions rise between the local populace and Sal's Pizza, a white-owned business, the owner Sal, and his sons, with Sal's delivery person caught between the two, all of which leads to a fatal act of violence and a riot. Why did you choose this film?
I chose this film. I kind of looked at the other films that other people have selected, and I thought it'd just be interesting to do a film that is very relevant, has continued to be relevant, particularly as I've watched it for the first time last year when we were all in lockdown and everything. And I was like, okay, there's all these films that I've never seen that are seminal classic films. So this was like the first of a group of films that I've watched. I've seen like a few Spike Lee films, but I'd never actually watched Do the Right Thing.
What did you think upon seeing it for the first time?
I loved it. I love that you just feel the electricity from it. The colour palette that he uses is so vibrant. You feel that heat of the day, that it is the hottest day, and you feel that oppression. And I thought it was really interesting watching it from a modern perspective. And I actually thought it was made in the 90s. I looked at a chance and it was made in 1989. The things that they were talking about in terms of the different racial tensions between every group of people. It covers everything. It covers gentrification, racism. It covers police violence, police oppression. I watched it just before everything happened with George Floyd and the protests that happened after that. And especially with the way Radio Raheem was killed with chokehold, it just really, really hits you that nothing has really changed. With Do the Right Thing, I actually did the masterclass that Spike Lee does on the masterclass subscription service. It's really interesting hearing him talking about his films. And when he was talking about Do the Right Thing, he said the problem is with the film is that nobody does the right thing. So everybody just needs to sort of take a step back and just listening. And that's the thing that I thought most about, just rewatching it and just thinking, is there anybody there who does do the right thing? And I thought, well, maybe the mayor, maybe he possibly. But even he is stoking racial tension when he goes into the shop owned by Korean immigrants, says racist things to them. Is it stoked more because of the heat?
Well, I first saw it when it came out because I've been around that long. And it was certainly a very exciting movie experience. I think at this moment, I should give a full disclosure. I'm not really a big Spike Lee fan, and we will get into that. I think he's just, to be honest, an okay filmmaker. But Do the Right Thing is the best film that he's done. And it was very exciting. It was very controversial. It got people talking. It really riled people up. It has now become one of the most important films of that period and may eventually become one of the most important films of all time, at least in America.
Mm. I think it's interesting you say that about, you know, thinking of him as an okay filmmaker, because I do really like him. And I think what's really interesting about his journey as a filmmaker is you can really see his journey in his films. I think that you can see him improving with every film. He's someone who's got a very distinctive style, like the shots of like people talking to camera, which is one of the things that I do really like about Do the Right Thing. But also, like, I just think of, she's got to have it. that there's something really problematic in that. She's attacked, she's raped. It's presented in a really odd way. One of her lovers just attacks her. And then they even talk about it afterwards. And she's like, oh, when you raped me the other night, in a really sort of weird, casual way. And I've heard Spike Lee sort of talk about things like that and go, no, that's not the right way to present it. I think he wouldn't make that film now, or not in that way. Yeah, and it's just interesting how you see someone learn as they go along, and also learn in terms of narrative style. Like, he still has always kept the tracking shot, you know, like with Sam Jackson's character, Senya Lovedaddy, the tracking shot of the camera being static and then someone being pulled towards the camera. And I really like those kind of visual flourishes.
What are some of your favorite scenes?
So many scenes in it that I really, really love. One scene that just really stick in my head is when, and it just makes me to sort of like shout at the screen, is when Mr. Mayer saves the boy from being hit by a car.
Right.
The boy's mom comes out and she's like berating him because he doesn't answer her fast enough. Oh, and he even says, oh, Mayer pushed me. And then he says, oh, no, I rescued him, pushed us both out of the... He's just trying to be sort of well-meaning. She ends up hitting her kid in front of everybody and everyone's like, whoa!
It is an interesting setup. It's sort of an irrational act of violence on her part. And everybody has different views of what happened. And the little boy lies about what happened because he knows that he's going to get in trouble. It's in many ways a very small parallel to what happens at the very end.
Yeah,
that
yeah,
these
definitely.
Things can get out of hand for often non-rational reasons. People don't do the right thing because they get into a position where they can't even think in terms of doing the right thing. The situation has taken control.
Definitely. And I think that's what I really like about it, is that moment of, oh, if you just like, just listen, let the boy talk, or let the mayor say his piece, or let him finish saying this. The essential point of nobody does the right thing.
Right. Perhaps my favorite scene, well, I have two favorite scenes, and they're the bookends of the movie. I think the opening dance number with Rosie Perez dancing to Fight the Power, which was written expressly for the movie, is really outstanding. It sets up the tension to come. It's just very visually stunning. And Rosie Perez is a great dancer.
I was reading an interview with, in fact, actually, it might have even been in the masterclass thing, where he was talking about, he basically found Rosie Perez, she was dancing in a club, and that's how he came across her. And he was like, yeah, she needs to do this. So I think that he did write that scene specifically for her to go like, yep, she can dance, like, let's do this.
And then, of course, the final confrontation and the riot at the end, which is done extremely well, is edited very well, is photographed very well, and doesn't resolve anything, which is pretty much the way life is. And in fact, people still debate what the ending means and what happened and how it happened and what could be done about it.
And I think what's interesting as well about that scene is actually at the very, very end is what happens afterwards. I like the Mookie goes back to Sal, I want my money. I think that's part of the whole life goes on. Like, everyone's in mourning, everyone's upset, but there's also life still going on. I really like the pan away at the end. Sal's is all burnt out, and then you just see everybody, like the guys playing basketball in the street again. And I think there's something incredibly Shakespearean about this film. I've never heard Spike Lee speak about this, but I think that is the way it's set up as well. There's something of Romeo and Juliet about it, that there's all these groups of people. It's like a little sort of West Side Story in terms of like vibrant colours and everything. The way that it starts with Sam Jackson's character, it really reminds me of like the opening of the play of Romeo and Juliet. And it's, you know, in Fair Verona, where we lay our scene, you know, Sam Jackson's commenting constantly about people walking up and down the street, like he's the chorus. And then there's just everything about the end and the way it plays out. And it just feels very, really, really Shakespearean.
Well, I think that's a very interesting observation. As I watch it, I often think of it as a tragedy, even a Shakespearean tragedy. My feeling about that is, in many ways, what makes it a tragedy is the heat. This is something that they have no control over, and it just keeps getting hotter and hotter and hotter. If it hadn't been so hot, none of this probably would have happened. A tragedy is when these awful things happen that are a combination of people making decisions combined with things that they can't control. And I think the comparison to Romeo and Juliet is very, very apt and also very insightful.
And I think Radio Raheem, he's a really big guy. Yeah, he's probably the tallest guy there. The police can murder him, and in front of all the people as well, and they're not caring what it means for everybody else. But at the end of the day, he's a black man living in where police brutality is real. And I do wonder if that was actually, you might know a bit more, if that was the first time that it was really shown in cinema.
Well, I'd have to go back to that time and think about it. There hadn't been very many films about racial relationships, at least from this perspective, with racial tensions. You would probably find something like this in the more Black exploitation films, or Sweetback's Badass Song in 1971, which wasn't exactly a Black exploitation film, but I think some people consider it the beginning of it, that does end with a riot and the local Black community ganging up on the cops. No one had seen something like that in a film before. But then it became Black exploitation. It took a while then to get to Do the Right Thing. Yeah. But Do the Right Thing was one of the very first films that really explored this issue with the depth or the artistry that Spike Lee and his group did.
Yeah, and I guess as well that with a film like this, because it is not just about the tragedy, because there's a lot of fun and joy and humour, just people going about their lives. I really like the relationship between mother, sister and the mayor, especially like towards the end where they're like we're the oldest and we're still standing. They've seen everything. And actually another scene that I do really like in that is the one with the white guy on the bicycle. It reveals to them that he owns the brownstone. Because I guess that would have been like the very beginning of gentrification.
That and the Korean store. A store like that opens in a neighborhood. If a coffee shop like Starbucks opens in a neighborhood, you know it's only a matter of time. Whereas Sal's has been there for 24 years. So the implication would be that he had actually opened it when it was a white neighborhood. And he saw it change into a Black neighborhood. And now if he holds on long enough, it will turn back into a white neighborhood again.
It's interesting just about the flow of communities and how different communities change and what causes that to change. Overriding factor always seems to be money. And just the fact that he kind of goes, yeah, I just bought it because you could. It's like, what's stopping me from buying this thing? Is that?
Ralph Novak, writing for People magazine, was one that panned the film. A lot of critics actually panned the film. Roger and Ebert were two of the critics that greatly supported it. But he panned the film as incoherent and having an unclear message and no likable characters. He said, if Lee is saying that racism is profoundly painful, frustrating, and confusing, no one will argue. But this film states the case without offering any insight. I think he's partly right. I do agree that the message is unclear and is at times incoherent. The characters aren't likable, but I think that is the insight.
Yeah.
Saying that racism is painful, frustrating, confusing is the insight. And I think a lot of people had issues with this film because Spike Lee didn't provide a solution.
I think it doesn't really offer a solution, but I think his point of finding a solution or a potential solution is people just to listen to each other. Sal just listening to the community with, why not? Why don't you just put some people from the Black community on the wall? There's so many people who just don't listen to each other. And I think that's what he's saying is the solution to it. I think with a lot of films that are political, I think a lot of people find things unsatisfactory when a reflection is shown, particularly if a reflection is shown that you might not agree with or something that shocks you. So, for example, I can imagine a lot of people who responded negatively to it were probably white critics, and it might have been a poor reflection of going like, oh, yeah, this is bad, like this is happening all over the US, and people want a solution to that rather than just be told, hey, you know, you're part of the problem.
Right. People want a solution. They have a problem with art that states a problem but doesn't state a resolution. And sometimes, yes, I can find that frustrating too, at other times not. And we'll also see that the same criticism was also leveled at Les Miserables, which has even a more ambiguous ending than Do the Thing.
Yeah, very much. And I think it's interesting actually about both films that the crossovers, like in Do the Right Thing, it's on a hot day. And there are moments of everyone like having fun, playing with the fire hydrant, playing in the street, and finally cooling off with some water. And then in Les Miserables.
Right, 30 degrees. And as the person says, if it was 35 degrees, it would be so hot they would be inside. But because it's 30 degrees, everybody's outside. And that's going to increase tension.
Yeah.
Some columnists had the opinion that the film could incite Black audiences to riot. Lee criticized these reviewers because they were suggesting that Black audiences couldn't restrain themselves. His quote was, "That still bugs the shit out of me, calling the remarks outrageous, egregious, and I think racist. I don't remember people saying we're going to come out of theaters killing people after they watched Arnold Schwarzenegger's films." I think he has a point, but I also think he doesn't. yes, they would not criticize that of Arnold Schwarzenegger because nobody could take the violence in Arnold Schwarzenegger films seriously. But they actually did criticize Scorsese films and later Tarantino films as being so violent. Tarantino was accused of contributing to the possibility of shootings in schools.
Yeah, that's true. I do agree with Spike Lee, though.
Well, I do think Lee's point is right on. It is a racist statement. Around the same time, there was a movie that came out that was called The Warriors, which was about gangs. And that was eventually pulled from a lot of theaters because there was gang-related violence connected to it. And it was, I believe, white gang.
I think that what kind of sort of scared the critics is that correlation. Oh, people can go out and do that. The idea that just because a black person sees their community reflected and sees police violence on screen and then sees people rising up against it, that will incite them to violence. That happens to them on a daily basis. It's such a strange comment. It's infuriating. And I think that the takeaway with both of these films actually is that infuriation of how does this all change? How do we fix all of this? And I have to say that it's something that we as white people, it's up to us to fix in terms of racial tensions because it's our system.
One of the biggest talking points of the film has always been the ending and why Mookie threw the garbage can through Sal's window. And there have been different theories. One is that he throws the garbage can to save Sal's life by redirecting the crowd's anger away from Sal, while others have said that it was an encouragement to enact violence caused by the death of Radio Raheem. How do you feel about the ending? Why do you think Mookie threw the garbage can?
So that's interesting. I know I heard about that maybe he was trying to save Sal. I'm not quite sure. I guess I could see how that...
I have to be honest. I think that's utterly ridiculous. And I just can't see how anybody thinks that, but it's usually white people who think that.
Yeah. The way I interpret it is that he's just had enough. This is him. He's just seen his friend be murdered. Throughout the whole thing, he's an intermediary between everybody. It's the go-between the white community and the Puerto Rican community and the black community. He's the sane constant between it all. And I think that's why it's important to see him just go, I've had enough. The only way I can be heard is by throwing this can. And I don't know if he really knows what would happen next about everyone just taking that as we're just going to tear this apart. And he doesn't get involved in the tearing apart either. What he wanted to do was just break something, just be heard.
For me, it was an irrational but very believable act. As the mayor said, you shouldn't be going after Sal. Sal did not kill Radio Raheem. You need to go after the police. They're the ones who did it. But the police aren't there.
Yeah.
As so often happens when something like this happens, you're going to take it out on somebody, even if he's not the primary cause. And Sal was there. That's another thing that makes it a tragedy, because in many ways, Sal did make a mistake. He shouldn't have taken the bat. He should have called the police and let the police handle it, though at the same time, Radio Raheem might have died that way as well. But what happens is Sal didn't cause the death of Radio Raheem. He didn't kill him, but he's there. Rioters often don't go after the people that cause their problems. They go after what's there. And it's irrational, but it's very believable and psychologically understandable.
Sal is part of that as well, because the police do side with Sal. So institutionally, he is part of the problem. He takes advantage of the advantages that are afforded to him because of the color of his skin. So he lives in that system and he benefits from it. So it does make sense that they rise up against him because they're rising up against everybody who's part of that system.
The original ending, at least the day after, was much more conciliatory in the original screenplay.
What was it meant to be?
Mookie and Sal find common ground. Sal comes to understand why what happened, and Mookie does regret what happened. But Lisa Jones, someone who wrote some books with Spike Lee and wrote about Spike Lee, and she thought that it was too nice. Spike Lee agreed and decided to make it a bit more tension-filled at the end, not so conciliatory. The original studio that was going to distribute the film wanted it even more so. They wanted a hug, and Spike Lee said, no, I'm out of here, and he got a different studio to distribute it. But we actually do know what happened to both Mookie and Sal, because they both appear in Red Hook Summer, another Spike Lee joint, in which Sal has taken the insurance money and opened a pizzeria in Red Hook. And Mookie is still delivering pizzas for him.
I haven't seen that. That's amazing.
Lee has been criticized for how he represents women.
Yeah.
People have said that he objectifies Black women the same way that white filmmakers write the characters as white women. Rosie Perez said, "My first experience with doing nude scenes was Do the Right Thing, and I had a big problem with it, mainly because I was afraid of what my family would think. That's what was really bothering me. It wasn't really about taking off my clothes, but I also didn't feel good about it because the atmosphere wasn't correct. And when Spike Lee puts ice cubes on my nipples, the reasons you don't see my head is because I'm crying. I was like, I don't want to do this." I think Spike Lee has acknowledged to some degree that he probably should have handled that better.
Yeah, I agree with it. And I've heard him say, I went to a talk with him where he didn't go into it very deeply. He wasn't even asked about it, but he mentioned as part of his answer, his attitudes have changed, basically, that he wouldn't do that same way. Yeah, that's horrible and shocking. And it's the reason why, very, very recent thing, having intimacy coordinators on set.
Well, as I said earlier, I did mention that I'm not that big a fan of Spike Lee. One of the reasons is, and I'm sure tons of people would disagree with me, I don't think he's that good a writer, to be honest. Do the Right Thing is probably his best film. He does some interesting things with the writing in that, as someone said, there is no subtext. It's all text. It's all there on the surface. Everybody will often just speak directly about what they feel, what's going on, what they think. And that was very interesting. But for me, what makes Spike Lee's movies, the ones that are good as they are, is almost totally because of his cinematographer, Ernest Dickerson.
Mm.
Ernest Dickerson, I think, has to be responsible for the incredible look of the film. It is beautiful to look at. The way the camera moves is remarkable. The use of Dutch angles, which were most famously used in Carol Reed's The Third Man, where the camera tilts and everything is now at a sharp angle, like the gables on a Dutch house.
Like, I like how that's the exact point of the chaos about to happen as well. So it's like,
right,
okay, this is the moment everything's going to go off.
But I watch his movies and I don't find them often very interesting, but I find them visually interesting. When Spike Lee made Malcolm X, I remember when this happened, Richard Attenborough was originally supposed to direct the film. And I think the original script was by James Baldwin. We all thought Richard Attenborough, I mean, he's a mediocre director. Gandhi's a mediocre film. I don't care what anybody says. But it's a biographical film, so they're giving it to Richard Attenborough. And Spike Lee got very upset and said that that was terrible to give it to Richard Attenborough, who was a white director. And we agreed, it was a terrible idea. But as my friend said, when we saw Malcolm X, Spike Lee, he made a movie that wasn't any better than what Richard Attenborough would have made. What made the movie so interesting and made it work so well was first Denzel Washington, who is one of our finest actors. And this was the last movie that Ernest Dickerson did with Spike Lee. When I watch Black Klansman, which is a fun movie to watch because it's based on his true story and you're going, can this really happen? This is remarkable. It's a very bland movie with no real visual style. And Ernest Dickerson was with him from the very beginning, even from the movies he made at college. In addition, the production designer, Wynn Thomas, altered the color scheme of everything. He got rid of anything that was green and blue, and he made everything red and orange and yellow. That gave the film this incredible visual look about it that also emphasized the heat. It often looked like paintings.
See, you're doing a disservice to him a little, because at the end of the day, like, he picks his team and has these people around him because he knows that they're going to make something great and make it how he wants. I think the writing comment I find interesting is I don't entirely agree that there isn't any subtext, but he does write things very plainly. But I think he does that because he wants to make things appealing to a wide audience. He wants people to see it. I think he wants white people to see his films so people understand what black communities are going through. You know, he is very political, like all the stuff like at the end of Black Klansman, where he's directly showing, hey, this is then, this is now, this is the same thing, this is all the same. I think my kind of criticism with his films is, and it's my criticism with a lot of films, is that they're often too long. I think he needs to make this a bit snappier. I think he does have a very distinctive style. I think you can tell it's a Spike Lee joint. But I really like the visuals in Black Klansman.
In closing out, I think we should cover certain controversies surrounding it when it came to awards. And the first one was the Cannes Award. This was sort of mind-boggling. It was premiered at Cannes, and he pretty much expected to win the Palme d'Or. He did get a jury prize nomination, but he did not win. Instead, for some reason, it went to Sex, Lies, and Videotape, a decision I will never understand. I mean, I may have certain issues with Spike Lee films. Sex, Lies, and Videotape is a terrible film. In fact, if you look at the list of the jury prize nominations, almost every single film nominated would have been a better choice than Sex, Lies, and Videotape. But Spike Lee got very upset. He blamed the jury president, Wim Wenders, for the loss. Someone told him that the German filmmaker found his lead character, Mookie, unheroic. Well, yeah, I don't think he's supposed to be heroic. I don't think that's the point. Sally Field told him that Sally Field was on the jury. Wenders was just hating on the movie. And the fellow jurors didn't understand why, at the end, Mookie tosses the trash can through a window. Spike Lee even was so angry he threatened Wim Wenders and said, I better not find him. And later he apologized for that. He sort of did a Mookie, I guess, at that point. But it was a mind-boggling choice that even today people just don't understand. It was not nominated for picture and director at the Oscars. And during the 1990 Oscar ceremony, while announcing the Best Picture nominees, Kim Basinger caused some controversy when she stopped reading the scripted text. And what she said was, "We've got five great films here, and they're great for one reason, because they tell the truth. But there is one film missing from this list that deserves to be on it, because ironically, it might tell the bigger truth of all, and that's Do the Right Thing." Now, what is so galling about this is that the winner was Driving Miss Daisy. Well, with that, here's some more information about the movie. It cost $6 million to make and made $37.3 million at the box office, so it did very well. As I said, it was nominated for 2 Academy Awards, Best Original Screenplay and Best Supporting Actor for Danny Aiello.
It's hilarious as well that the white guy gets the nomination.
Yes, and some people did point that out. At the same time, who else are you going to nominate for supporting actor in the movie? He has the largest part, but it certainly couldn't have been Spike Lee, because this is another area where a lot of people might disagree with me. I think he's a terrible actor. But
I don't think he's really bad, but I think he's pretty bad. I don't think he's, in terms of like director's acting, he's nowhere near as bad as Quentin Tarantino.
I think you might be right there. In 1999, the film was deemed culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant by the Library of Congress in its first year of eligibility and was selected for preservation in the National Film Registry. Lee first got the idea for the film after watching Alfred Hitchcock Presents episode Shopping for Death, in which the main characters discuss their theory that hot weather increases violent tendencies. Then he was also inspired by the 1986 Howard Beach racial incident, in which a black youth was chased from a pizzeria and was hit by a car and killed. And then also the shooting of Eleanor Bumpers by police. The title comes from a Malcolm X quotation that goes, "You've got to do the right thing." Spike Lee wanted Robert De Niro for Sal, and I've read two things. He either had prior commitments or resembled too many of his other roles. This was Rosie Perez's film debut. Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee were husband and wife and longtime acting partners. The film was shot entirely on Stuyvesant Avenue between Quincy Street and Lexington Avenue in the Bedford-Stuyvesant neighborhood of Brooklyn. The Korean grocery store and Sal's Pizzeria were built from scratch on the two empty lots. The pizzeria was fully functional and the actors cooked pizzas in the ovens. Then it was taken down after the film was done. Many television series have parodied the trash can scene, including The Boondocks and Bob's Burgers. In 2014, the 25th anniversary of the film, Barack and Michelle Obama praised the film and said they went to see it together on their first date. This was later referenced in the 2016 film Southside with You, where Barack discusses Mookie's motives with a white colleague after seeing the film. With that, let's get to my selection, and that is Les Miserables. First, some information about the film. Les Miserables is a French film released in 2019. It was directed by Lage Lee from a screenplay by Lee, Giordano Gederlini, and Alexis Manenti, who also stars. And it's based on Lee's 2017 short film of the same name. I also feel I should point out, as many people did during the year, it is not based on the novel by Victor Hugo. However, Victor Hugo did write Les Miserables in the neighborhood where the story takes place. It stars Damien Bernard, Alexis Manente, Jabril Zonga, Issa Parika, Al Hassan Lee, Steve Tianshu, Amami Kanfenoiti, I know I'll get most of these wrong, Jean Balabar, Raymond Lopez, Omar Somer, Sana Joaquim, Lucas Amiri, and Nasser bin Fatma. The story revolves around a police officer newly transferred to Paris, assigned to ride with two fellow officers and patrol the neighborhood of Montfermeil, a suburb of Paris. The area is made up largely of immigrants and criminal gangs in an uneasy truce. But when one of the officers injures a teenager from the neighborhood who stole a lion cub from a nearby circus, and when that injury is caught on film by a drone, the neighborhood threatens to erupt in violence. What do you think of the pairing of the two films?
The big thing about both of them is that they are both films about people just not doing the right thing, and also the relationship between excessive police force. You know, and there is one point where you think there has been a killing of someone from the public by a police officer, but luckily he survives. Yeah, but I think overall it's that feeling of nobody listening to each other and about different communities. And they do actually engage quite a lot with each other, all the different tribal leaders.
Yeah, and Do the Right Thing, I would say a lot of the interaction is just tension caused by the heat and to a certain degree by different ethnic backgrounds. But in Les Miserables, it goes beyond that because it's also people trying to maintain power.
Just going back to what you were saying before, I think there is more layers with this because there is that power element as well. Because I think Do the Right Thing, everyone's just trying to exist. Everyone's just trying to get along. And in a way, everyone in Les Mis is trying to get along, but there is that power as well between all of the male leaders of each community that exists there. Literally, in the case of the gypsy circus owners, they come out with their chests exposed with big sticks in a very display of macho.
And won't even tell them what they want. You think we know what you want, but we have absolutely no idea what you're talking about. But I did think it's interesting when you said that in Do the Right Things, they're trying to get through the day. But in Les Miserables, not only are they trying to get through the day, they're trying to survive. And surviving in this neighborhood is much more difficult than surviving in the Brooklyn neighborhood in Do the Right Thing. I also thought it was a little interesting that both movies have a character called the mayor.
Yeah, and it's something I only realized as well is like both directors is basically Lee. I just found that quite funny as well. Obviously, it's felt very differently. And I'd quite like to learn a bit more about, largely just about what were his inspirations apart from, I know he mentioned about the 2005 riots in France, but just in terms of the creative influences, like if he was inspired by Do the Right Thing or...
I wouldn't doubt it because so many people, when they talk about Les Miserables, they talk about whether this film could have been made or be what it was without Do the Right Thing. So a lot of people do see a lot of similarities. When did you first see the film?
Last week, I think.
What did you think of it?
I really love it. I really, really love it. Because I heard about it when it came out and it's just like one of those films that like, okay, I'll get around to watching it. And I just heard that it was a tough watch. So you kind of have to build yourself up to watching it. But I found it incredibly engaging. I thought it was really beautifully shot. I loved how those characters, you just want them just to do better and you just want them to be better. The cop, Porky, he's just such a horrible human being. The way he harasses like really young girls on the street, he does it because it's just part of his fun. I did actually read an interview with Lashley where he was talking about every incident that happens in the film are incidents that happened. That scene in particular, just knowing what that's like and that feeling of powerlessness in those situations. Yeah, it was just very, very visceral. And something that I found really interesting, and it's written into the script as well, is the really incredible aerial shots of the neighbourhood. Really, really beautiful. And you get such a good encapsulation of the world. And it's also written into the story that one of the kids has got a drone. Reminded me as well of La Haine as well, because it starts with that incredible sweeping shot through the neighbourhood. And then it lands in someone's apartment. And I quite like the comparison between the two.
I saw it when it came out, and at first I was hesitant, and I think you were spot on as to why. Did I really want to watch what was going to be a very difficult film to watch? But it was the French entry in the foreign film category, so of course I had to watch it. And like you, I was really impressed and overwhelmed by it. I thought it was a very powerful movie. I was surprised at that, even though it was a very difficult watch, how much it drew me in and that I did enjoy watching it, if that's the correct word. As frustrating as it was, like in Do the Right Thing, you keep wanting to tell these people, stop doing that, don't do that. What are some of your favorite scenes? You mentioned the beautiful drone shots, which are incredibly beautiful and often very powerful, but do you have other favorite scenes?
There are quite a few that really resonated. I like the different like sort of moments of humour in there. And I don't know if this was intended, but the bit where they're all in the restaurant and it's like all the gangs are all there, like all the leaders are all there.
They all gather and they're all vying for power.
Yeah, and they're all in this like tiny little restaurant. So and nobody really knows what to do because Salah, that, and nobody really knows how to treat him either. I find him one of like the most fascinating characters because he is now a religious man, a religious leader, but he used to be on the streets with the mayor. And they even criticise him in that scene, saying something along the lines, we know who you really are, we know your true nature. But there's this bit where he just suddenly shouts, I am the law. And I don't know if that was meant to be like Judge Dredd.
Yeah, I have read that people wonder whether he got that from the movie. Yeah. I also like that Greaser or Stefan, the new person on the block, was the only one who was able to resolve the situation. He's the only one who could resolve any of these issues.
And he does that by listening, by talking to someone, by speaking calmly. A couple of the scenes that really sort of stayed with me when Greaser, Stefan, where he is telling the black cop.
Guada.
Where he's telling it, and it's his neighborhood, and then Greaser is telling him how he should deal with things. It's like white people thinking that they know better coming in and telling him how to deal with things in his neighborhood. I mean, he does shoot the kid in the face
and does it pretty much on purpose, as he says, you can't fire those guns by accident.
He did it in anger, he did it in frustration. That's why he pulled the trigger. And he forgot that this is a kid, he's part of that community. He became the them of us versus them, a police outsider rather than a human being from that community, and recognizing that they're just kids. And Greaser says to him, but you're surrounded by a bunch of kids, and that's your defense, that you're surrounded by kids. And that's why you shot one of them in the face. Which is also interesting because my other scene that really stayed with me is the very end where everything erupts because the kids do all get together, they organise and they rise up against everything else. The bit in particular that stays with me is when the mayor, thinking that he can go all the way past them, they'll listen to him, he's in charge of the community, he's not afraid of them. That at least he just wants to watch the world burn down. And you get that in scenes after he's dropped off by the police. At one point, you think he's going to jump off the top of the building where he's despondent. When he attacks the mayor, he's, I don't care about the consequences of this.
But yes, they do go after everybody in that final riot. I agree with you. That's a very powerful set of scenes. He not only goes after the mayor because they shoot one of their rockets or missiles into the headquarters of the mayor, but when the other gang, and I think they're basically white, show up, they shoot into the car and those guys run off. The only people they don't attack is the Muslim Brotherhood. Mm. They're just annoying to them. The Muslim Brotherhood doesn't really cause them any real problem. They're just annoying. Come to church, Iju will read from the Quran and they're going, okay. But they're not the same kind of threat everybody else is. And the final image of Greaser or Stefan with the gun at Issa, the boy who has the Molotov cocktail, and it ends ambiguously. We don't know what's going to happen. Like in Do the Right Thing, is there really an answer? We've gotten to a point. So is there a way to resolve all of this? Mm. I also thought that the scene where Issa is taken into the lion cage was really terrifying.
Yeah.
And that was about the only time I felt sorry for Chris, who has this gun. If he shoots, he has to shoot the lion. But if he shoots the lion, that's going to erupt in incredible violence. And he just can't shoot the gun as a warning, because if he shoots the gun as a warning, the lion's going to attack.
It's really terrifying, that bit, just like saying, because he's just so terrified.
One way of looking at the three characters, the three police officers, is through a Freudian psychology. We have Chris, who is the id. He's the primitive, instinctual part of the mind, sexually aggressive, physically aggressive, just acts out without any real restraint. And then you have Greaser Stefan. He's the superego who's trying to operate as a moral conscience. He's trying to keep telling everybody what the right thing to do is. And you have Guada, who is the ego who's theoretically supposed to resolve the id and the superego. But Guada is getting to the point where the ego doesn't really have any power.
And he is completely powerless, so he loses control as well.
He won't stand up to Chris, whereas Stefan will stand up to him. He'll go up to him and say, you can't do this to these teenage girls. And it takes the boy, even though he agrees not to take the boy to the hospital, he takes the boy to a drugstore so he can get him something to take care of his eye, because he's a first responder and he knows what to do.
Because at that point you think, oh, he's actually going to take him to the hospital. And no, he just takes him to go and get something to patch his eyes up with. And she did something that I think is really interesting was a comparison between both films, in that because at the end of Do the Right Thing, there's the quote from Malcolm X about, I think it's Malcolm X.
He quotes both Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, where Martin Luther King preaches peaceful confrontation and Malcolm X says, sometimes you have to be violent.
Mm.
This does end with a quote by Victor Hugo.
Yeah, I think he did the right thing. I can't remember if it's Martin Luther King or Malcolm X, something about eye for an eye. Whereas Les Mis here literally is someone's eye is taken, like Lisa's eye is taken. And then he goes and organizes and tries to take the other eyes. He retaliates. It's creating that shock element of we are angry, we are making ourselves heard. At the end, you're not quite sure about what's going to happen. Like, is he going to throw the Molotov cocktail or will Greaser shoot back, which will happen? Tell that Greaser doesn't want to shoot him and he's just got that pain in his eyes. Don't make me shoot you. Like, don't make me shoot you.
And Issa's also hesitating too.
Yeah.
This police officer was the only one who showed him any kindness. The ending is very ambiguous, like it doesn't do the right thing. Peter Bradshaw, The Guardian, said it's a movie that builds to a confrontation that isn't satisfying dramatically. But I do find the ending very satisfying. There isn't really an easy answer. It's stating a problem, but it's not giving an answer. Like in Do the Right Thing, it's stating a problem, but it isn't giving an answer. The problem is in movies like this, where you state problems, almost every time when you give an answer, it's a real letdown. Because it's a simplified answer usually. It's not really going to solve the problem. It's not really going to help. And that's often also not satisfying dramatically. And I'd rather have the ambiguity, which anybody who has seen a lot of European films has no problem with ambiguity at the end of the films.
Yeah, I do like the ending. I like that it is ambiguous because essentially Issa and Greaser are both good people. But one is caught up in this job where he has to do things that he doesn't want to do. But then Issa has been pushed to a point. Want them both just to put their weapons down. I don't know what you think, but part of me wonders, my hope is that they both put their weapons down.
That wouldn't satisfy me dramatically. That would be like Sal and Mookie hugging each other. Do the Right Thing, I said that it was Ernest Dickerson, I think, who is in many ways primarily responsible for the success of the film. And though I think Lars Lee did a wonderful job of directing here, I think one of the things that is primarily responsible for the success of this film is the incredible editing by Flora Valpelliere. It did win awards for that. And it is amazing the way the film looks, the way it's edited, the way everything is put together. The cinematography is also quite wonderful, especially with those drone shots. But technically, it's also a rather strong film.
I think it's just such a perfectly put together film, just showing you that snapshot of life for a particular place and the communities that live within it and the way it shows like all the small glimpses of everything. Like when they go into Issa's house and the women are in the other room and putting their money together, that small little snapshot of this is this community, this is what they do. Just all those very small interactions. Another bit that I really like is the kids near the beginning where they're on car doors, where they're doing a slide.
Right.
Yeah, and just seeing small moments of joy, how people pass their time. I really love actually the way that the kids all talk to each other as well. That just feels very natural and just very true as well.
With that, here's some more information about the film. It made $18.9 million. I don't know how much it cost to make, but I think it's probably safe to say that it did very well.
Yeah.
It had its world premiere on May 15th, 2019 at the Cannes Film Festival, where it won the jury prize. But it did not win the Palme d'Or. That was the year of Parasite, which won the top prize. It was selected as the French entry for Best Foreign Language Film at the 92nd Academy Awards. And it did actually become one of the five final nominees. But again, this was the year of Parasite, which won both Best Picture and Best Foreign Language Film. It earned 12 nominations at the César Awards, and the César Awards are the French version of the Oscars. It won 4 of them, including Best Film, Best Editing, Most Promising Actor in Alex Menente, and a special César du Public. Roman Polanski won the Best Director that year. Do you want to make any guesses as to what won Best Foreign Film?
Probably Parasites?
Yes, it was Parasite. It was a tough year. Parasite was a great movie. What can you do? Le Journal du Dimanche revealed that Emmanuel Macron was upset by the accuracy of Les Miserables, so much that he asked the government to hurry to find ideas and act to improve living conditions in the banlieues, which are public housing. But as Jacques Dion in the magazine Marianne said, that Marcon must never have heard of the Berlue plan, because that was a plan to help in the public housing sections. But Marcon had abandoned that. In closing out, I asked you to choose a film or two to go with your choice that might interest our audience.
That's what I mentioned it briefly before, but La Haine, which is from 1975, famous, like everybody in the US kind of knows who Vincent Cassel is.
I think that was his film debut.
I think the three main characters there are all a first film.
Oh, great. I've chosen four films. Go through those real quickly. Detroit is Catherine Bigelow's brilliant and underrated 2017 movie about events taking place during the Detroit riots of 1967. The 1979 film Quadrophenia dramatizes the events leading up to the 1964 Brighton riots between the Mods and the Rockers. In the Mangrove episode of Steve McQueen's Small Axe, which is a series of films that you can now see on Amazon that revolve around the Jamaican neighborhoods in London during, I think, the 60s through the 80s. This one centers on the violent confrontation between police officers and a Jamaican restaurant in 1971. And then the documentary Stonewall Uprising, an episode in the American Experience series on PBS, chronicles the confrontation between the gay population of Greenwich Village and the police in 1969 at the Stonewall Inn Bar, which led to the modern gay rights movement. So what is next? What should we be looking for from you?
There's a film, hopefully, that's going to come out quite soon in the US called Mogul Mowgli. I was sort of involved in kind of very latterly, but very close to my heart, and just been nominated for a BAFTA as well for Extended British Film. I did a film last year called Pig with Nicolas Cage that will be coming out hopefully this year as well. And I've got a few short films online as well at the moment. I have one called The Nest Egg. I directed my first short last year called An Ode to Jars, which is just 90 seconds long. And that's on YouTube.
As for me, I will go through my usual litany. I'm a screenwriter and script consultant, so I have a Howard Kasner Facebook consultation page. My blog is called Rantings and Ravings. With that, I deal with issues concerning screenwriting and movies. I've published two books of short stories on Amazon, The Starving Artist and Other Stories, and The Five Corporations and One True Religion. These are sci-fi, fantasy, and horror short stories. The second edition of my screenwriting book, More Rantings and Ravings of a Screenplay Reader, is also available on Amazon. And I'm an amateur photographer, and you can find those on Instagram. The previous podcast was with fellow podcaster Jarrett Galante, a.k.a. Clark F. Gable, where we discussed True Romance and Pierrot Le Fou, two films about lovers on the run. I am now going to take a week off and return with filmmaker Keith Hartman, where we will discuss Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse and Coherence, two films about parallel universes. So with that, Martina, I want to thank you very much for being a guest on my show.
No, thank you. It's been really good.